أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمخلوقين سيدنا ونبينا وشفينا أبو القاسم محمد صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم. My dear sisters and brothers, Assalamu alaikum. I have been away, so I have not been fortunate enough to attend all the 6 lectures which have gone so far. I could only attend yesterday. But I believe from what I have heard that you have covered some aspects of the spiritual dimensions of Muharram, and also how the narrative or the recounting or the use of the Muharram narrative or the events of Karbala have been used in different times in different ways. Now, my friends in the executive committee have been asking me for some time what is going to be my topic for these 3 sessions. So I want to outline for you what I propose to cover in the next 3 nights. I believe that it is very important to get a deeper and much more systematic understanding of what actually led to Karbala. It is not an event which happened out of the blue, and it is not an event which is not situated in history. So what we propose to do today is to look at history as a whole. We see how people interpret history and how these kinds of interpretation can allow us to figure out what were the main drivers for the events of Karbala. Tomorrow we will move to the main players behind the Karbala event and analyze their motivations and where they were coming from. And the day after, inshallah, we will see what has happened post the events of Karbala and how these have shaped the course of Muslim history. Now, my friend Abdul Karim Wakil yesterday recounted a number of couplets or semi-poems from Allama Iqbal on the importance of both Imam Ali alayhi salam and the events of Karbala. And many thinkers amongst Muslims, thinkers, mystics, writers, scholars, have reflected on this event and have concluded that this is the central event in the history of Islam. Well, this is not also, and we must bear it in mind, that this is not an exclusively Shi'i event. Karbala is believed in, commemorated, and digested by a large section of the Muslim communities across the world. Let me just start with giving you, before I go into the subject matter for today, 2 small couplets. One is by Khwaja Moinuddin Chishti, whose shrine is in Ajmer in India, and he is widely regarded as the mystic saint of India. Even today, millions of people visit his shrine to seek blessings from his presence. And he says, Shah Hast Hussain, Bad Shah Hast Hussain, Shah Hast Hussain, Bad Shah Hast Hussain, Sardad Nadad Dar Dast Yazid, Hakka Ke Bina Ela Ela Hast Hussain. King is Hussain, and the King of Kings indeed is Hussain. He is the one who did not bend to the whims of Yazid when it came to truth. He stuck firmly to his belief in one God and did not compromise it. In a similar vein, but slightly more expanded, Allama Iqbal himself, in one of his Urdu couplets, says, Islam ke daman mein bas do hi to cheez hai. Islam ke daman mein bas do hi to cheez hai. Ek hai zarbe yadullahi, dusra sajde shabiri. That in the body of Islam, there is nothing but two things. One, he calls Zarbe Yadullahi, which we all know, is the stroke of Imam Ali's sword, the hand of Allah. And the other one is the last sajda of Imam Hussain alayhi salam in Karbala. So, ek hai Zarbe Yadullahi, dusra sajde shabiri. So you see, from mystics to great thinkers, poets, philosophers, they understand the centrality of this event and the importance it has in the history of Islam. Now we want to figure out how to arrive at this centrality and how to get a deeper appreciation of what is going on. In order to do that, we have to begin by looking at what is history. If you think about it, and in very simplistic terms, people start to think about it, they start by thinking that history is only a chronology, a recording of a chronology of events. So you find people who write that this happened and this happened and this happened. And sometimes they add a little bit of salt and pepper to what happened. But that's all. Now, that is not history. That is just record keeping. Even in that simple record keeping, you could see that different people always record the same event quite differently. And you think, are these people not seeing the same thing? But you find that really they record it quite differently. And if it is not a written record and you transmit it orally, then over a period of time, you find that that narrative has been completely changed to something else, depending on who is transmitting and what is the purpose of that transmission. The other part of history is that predominantly what has come down as history is what I would call his story, men's version of events. There is a complete absence, more or less, all the time of any narrative, any explanation from the side of women, as far as history recording is concerned, as if they did not form any part of history. And Abdul Karim has done quite a good job of correcting some of those gender biases, and we don't need to really look at this. The third aspect of history, which is even more interesting, is that history only records the activities of the victors. Those who have been defeated more or less lose their record in history, because the victors make sure that their version of events prevail. So if this is true for only very simple things like chronological recording of history, can we say that there is something more in history which we can figure out? And this is something which will bring us closer to our purpose. One of the deeper insights, and one of the reasons why people study history, is not to just read what happened, but to see if there are any lessons in history, if we can learn from history. Does history reflect any underlying human behavioral characteristics, or is it just a collection of chronology? And a large number of people have started to think through how to make some theory about history. And this is something is developed in a quite systematic manner in disciplines like the sociology of history, to try to figure out what is the underlying nature of this history. And some of it will be quite disturbing. Some of it could be quite dangerous. Let's look at two or three examples to give you a feeling of what we are saying. You look at Marx, Karl Marx. Marx, after reading and analyzing the developments in industrial societies, came up with a thesis that in industrial societies or industrializing societies, which relied on a mixture of capital and labor, the natural tendency of capital to exploit labor will eventually result in labor becoming so frustrated and upset that it will overthrow the owners of capital and socialize the whole state. This is, of course, the underlying thesis of communism. Now, this was Marx's reading of history, that this is going to happen, or happens. But when it becomes dangerous, Marx put forward the idea that not only it has happened in history, but it is bound to happen in the future. And this is something which we call deterministic history, that it is inevitable that this will happen in industrial societies. So we don't have time in that, but just to mention to you that somebody like Lenin, who was in Russia, which was not an industrial state at that time, when he read Marx, he was quite excited by the possibility of overthrowing the despotic order in Russia. But he understood that Russia was nowhere near an industrial society. It was still largely agricultural society. So Lenin now argues that if this transformation is inevitable in history, can't we take it in our hands to push it on, to move history along, and therefore take over by force and make sure that that transformation happens? So that's why communism became established in Russia through force and oppression rather than by natural process, which Marx was hypothesizing. And Marx may be wrong, and he has some very deep insights into the process of history. But here we just want to look at ways of analyzing history to see whether there are any underlying events. On a slightly different note, if you look at the position of somebody like Henry VIII here, Henry, as we all know, was the King of England, and he was labeled as the defender of faith by the Pope at that time. Unfortunately, his wife could not beget a son or an heir to the throne. So he wanted to divorce her. So he went to the Pope, and as you know that in Catholicism there is no concept of divorce. So for the first time, the Catholic Church came up with a formula which is called annulment. This suggested that he told Henry that we would annul your marriage, which means that the marriage never took place in the first place. So there is no question of divorce. And you can go and marry another woman. Now when this happened the second time, his second wife also could not beget heir. Then Henry went to the Pope and he said, I want to divorce her again. So he can't continue to do this. This is too problematic. And he also, of course, executed his own archbishop, who also said, this is going too far. Henry said, fine. If that is the case, we are going to establish a new church. We are going to separate from you. Now here you see history taking a different turn because the behavior of a particular monarch. And English history would have been quite different if only Henry would have been able to have a son. It wouldn't have taken the turn of being towards Protestantism, and there are lots of other things in English history which we may discuss at some point when we have a Friday lecture on this. But it's just here to tell you what happens when you look at history from a different angle. There are two more examples before we come to our main subject here. Sometimes you tend to look at history and events from a point of view to cover up your crimes. So for example, as Abdul Karim mentioned, there is this masterpiece by Professor Edward Said called Orientalism. And Edward Said shows that in order to carry out the barbarity of the Crusades, Europe had to build an image of Muslims as barbarians, womanizers, drinkers, good for nothing, savages. Because how do you otherwise motivate your people to go and kill indiscriminately? In fact, if you read the reports, you will see that when Jerusalem was conquered, the whole city is said to be like a river of blood. So this kind of barbarity in the name of religion, to inspire that kind of barbarity, you had to change a whole historical narrative to inform the people that these people whom you are going to attack or capture are not worth it. And all these aspects will come back into our Karbala narrative later on, tomorrow and day after. The final example I want to go is the image of the African Americans in the United States. Until the last 50 years, there was an image that really the white people were kind enough to rescue these savages from the African continent and bring them to America, if only as slaves. But that was fine, because they were not better than slaves where they were. And when somebody like Alex Haley started to look at this narrative, Alex Haley being an African American, he said, "What is this talk about my origin? Let me go and investigate." And if you read Roots now, you see that in his journey he discovers something which opens a whole new way of looking at the history of African Americans. He finds that in the Gambia of that time, the people who were said to be savages were actually living in nice Muslim communities in a much more civilized fashion than the barbaric slave traders who came to capture them. That they were transported across the Atlantic. At least 20 million were killed in just the process of transportation. And they were brought to the Americas, where the white people had already decimated 40 million Native Americans. When you look at that narrative, you find that the whole of the American historic narrative is based on murder and barbarity. And the African American, after this kind of awakening, started to understand that they are in no way going to be subjected by these peoples. So again, another interpretation of history changes the way you think about yourself or other people and so on. And there is one particular way of looking history which is also quite interesting and which is bringing us closer to our topic. And that is the analysis of somebody like Dr. Ali Shariati. Shariati, as many of you may know, was born and brought up in Mashhad, in Khorasan, but spent a lot of his time studying sociology in France. And it's sociology really which equipped him to analyze these issues. And many of us, I think, would have been able and have been reading his book on things like Hajj and so on. But his most important book, as far as our topic is concerned today, is called Tashayyu'e Alawi or Tashayyu'e Safavi. Alawi Shi'ism versus Safavi Shi'ism. Shariati, in his analysis, puts forward this clear idea that if the followers of Imam Ali alayhi salam are operating under a patronage and umbrella of the Safavis, is the requirements of the Safavi throne and the narrative they want to promote going to influence their activities? And this is the core of the objection to Shariati in many religious circles, because Shariati goes on to posit that many of the leading scholars and chroniclers, philosophers in the Safavi times and afterwards were subject to this constraint. Very shortly and very clearly he says, can you speak truth to power when you are an employee of that power? The answer clearly is not as easily as otherwise. And so if the whole idea of Karbala for Imam Hussein to speak truth to power, the power of the Umayyads, telling them that what you are doing is not what is Islam, then does that kind of subservience to even a Safavi umbrella compromise your situation? And Shariati here, you can see, opens a can of worms which is even to this day difficult to contain. So you can see now that history is not a simple and passive thing. Many, many things can be derived from there. Just one aspect, again from Shariati. Shariati starts his discovery by writing a book which he calls Abu Dharr, or is from Abu Dharr Ghaffari, who was one of the companions of the Prophet. And the characteristics of Abu Dharr in this context are also important. When in the first 50-100 years the Islamic domain started to expand rapidly with Persia and Rome, Byzantine and all coming into the picture, obviously the number and scale of revenues from all these places multiplied manifold. Now when they were poor, they were sharing everything. Now they are extremely rich, beyond their wildest dreams. Would they continue to share, or would they want to expropriate for their kinsmen, for their family, for whatever? And during the time of the third caliph, Abu Dharr was admonishing them that, look, what you are doing, and we will see that tomorrow, is wrong, because you are subverting the basic message of the Prophet. In the end, the caliph decided that this man is too troublesome. Every day he stands outside the mosque and, you know, makes us uncomfortable. The best thing is to exile him. And so they forcibly exiled him so that their conscience could be clear in what they were doing. And this aspect of the increase in wealth and how you would share it will also feature in the Karbala narrative as one of the contributing components. Okay. That's enough for history. Now, in this particular aspect of analyzing Karbala, we want to look at one particular aspect of history. And this has been put forward by the historian and sociologist Ibn Khaldun. Ibn Khaldun has written what is called a history of the world. But apart from his history, he has written an introduction to the history of the world, which is called the Muqaddima. Muqaddima, of course, in Arabic, meaning the introduction. The introduction is translated in 3 volumes by Rosenthal, so the introduction itself is 1500 to 2000 pages of his book. So vast. But the beauty of Ibn Khaldun's work is that he analyzes how events develop in the world. So he goes and he looks at how rural societies become urbanized, and then how urban societies developed, and how they grow, and how they rule themselves. And he finds in many, many cases which he examines that generally, of course, without urban settlements, you can't have the kind of developments which we are used to. You can't have arts, you can't have culture, you can't have industry, because rural settings don't allow for specialization. You have to do everything yourself. But urban settings allow for specialization. So you do one thing and you get the rest of your requirements from other people through a means of exchange. And then, of course, that leads to development of commerce and everything. But who will rule that? So Ibn Khaldun figures out that there are, in every situation, certain families, certain tribes who lead on this, and then they try to preserve their monopoly of leadership. And he analyzes this in great detail and comes up with his thesis of what is called Asabiya. It's a mixture of tribal blood kind of lineage structure. And he says that this is the rule in history, that every time people like to favor their own, promote their own, control everything by promoting their own. And Ibn Khaldun comes to, this is not relevant to ours, is relevant here, comes to a very interesting explanation of how this thing collapses. So you have managed to establish control over a country or an area, and your family is in full control. How does it lose that? And he puts forward a very interesting idea. He says that when you become very rich and wealthy, and you are threatened by somebody from outside, the same force which wants you to perpetuate the thing for your people tells you that you will not send your own sons to battle. Because you think, why should I get my son killed? I am the king. So he said, you start hiring mercenaries to defend the realm. And mercenaries being mercenaries, somebody pays them a higher price, they switch sides and you are dead. And that is how you lose. And we will see some other time how some empires have lost. But here the relevance is that he finds tribal lineages, tribal factors, blood relationships as the key to development of all kinds of society. And he analyzes the first years of Islamic history in this context. So he says, let's look at this. Makkah of that time, and in fact the peninsula, Arabian peninsula of that time, as we know, was dominated by the Quraysh in terms of leadership. So if somebody came and wanted to supplant the Quraysh, they would all gang together and defend themselves. And we know from the description of Jahiliyyah that one of the characteristics was that you would defend your blood relations, whether they are right or wrong. They had to be blood relations. You wouldn't bother to judge them. You say, this is my relative and therefore I will defend them. In this context, the Prophet comes. Ibn Khaldun analyzes it very well. If you look at the Prophet, his message, of course he's coming from not the top branch of the Quraysh, but he's coming from a Quraysh branch, and tomorrow I'll put up a chart of the lineage. So he is part of the ruling tribe in that place, so there's no problem there. But the message is so upsetting to his own people that he begins to gather around him people who are completely at the periphery of that society. So you have Bilal, you have people like Miqdad, both are from Habasha, Africa. You have Salman, who is from Fars. You have Abu Dharr, and you have all kinds of people who the Quraysh say, who are these people? These are riffraffs. How can we even consider them as part of the ruling group? So Ibn Khaldun says the Prophet really disturbs the whole pattern of that society and the normal pattern of development and control of that society by bringing a concept which is too radical. And Professor Izutsu, in his book Ethico-Religious Concepts in the Quran, looks at this. And it's one of the geniuses of the Prophet was to, over a period of time, not initially, initially of course, as I said, there is this resistance because of this, is to put forward an idea which was very close to their hearts, to defend your own with everything you have, but convert it from tribe to brother in faith or co-religionist. And so the Ummah became the source of action rather than the tribe, the Quraysh or whatever. And this was a radical transformation in that situation. Now Ibn Khaldun says that when the Prophet was there, because of his charisma and the revelations which came to him, he could manage that disruption in that order. But as soon as he passed away, the old order started to mobilize and started to, you know, come forward and say, see if they could again get rid of all this and come back to tribal loyalty and tribal rule of the Quraysh or parts of the Quraysh. And in fact, on the day that Makkah was conquered by the Prophet, there is a very interesting quote
from Abu Sufyan. This is a personality we are going to look at tomorrow, inshallah. Abu Sufyan, and of course his son Muawiyah, and so on. These were the people who did not convert until that day. They converted on the day Makkah was conquered. They have felt that now there is nothing we can do. We have to really toe the line. We have tried and resisted, and we have lost. So he says to the Prophet's uncle, Abbas, he says that, O Abbas, your nephew, that is Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, has finally captured the whole of Arabia for us. You see the tribal implication there. And Abbas says, no, this is not my nephew's kingdom. This is Allah's kingdom. But 40 years later, Muawiyah implements that. Abu Sufyan's son says, Ana awwalul mulk. I am the first person in our tribe to establish a kingdom. And we will see that. Now, so Ibn Khaldun says that whilst the Prophet was able to shake this whole thing during his time and a bit later, the tensions which were generated by the forces of history as they moved were sufficient to disrupt this prophetic spark and try to create tensions to go back to how the history was moving in that place before. And one of the things we want to see tomorrow is that what were these forces which mobilized and how in order to subvert the whole message of the Prophet. And you will see tomorrow, inshallah, that why the centrality of Imam Hussein's struggle in Karbala was important to keep that spark alive forever. Because the idea of speaking truth to power, especially when that power is claiming to be the Islamic power, was only possible in the way he managed it. So I hope, inshallah, tomorrow we can get to the meat, and then day after we can draw some conclusions from there. Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you very much. We have some time for questions. Are there any questions? Any questions from the ladies' side?
Just the things arise in my mind that the Rasulullah ﷺ has changed, as you said it, the whole tribe way of living in changing the society and the mind within the community and the whole Ummah and whole nation. Do you think the Muslim recognizing this at the present time? And that's what I think the message of Karbala was precisely telling, that take the things in your hand. And we do know by now the division amongst the Muslim bring us to the point that we're not really doing this. Do you agree, or do you or do you think my question is not relevant to your talk?
No, I think What you're hinting at, and I, if I understand it correctly, I think that what Karbala introduces is a continuing corrective mechanism throughout history of a way to challenge deviations, challenge the human tendency to think and go away from the message of Allah. As, for example, you could see that Abu Dharr was challenging it in a small way, but he could be exiled and forgotten. But this, as we will see in the day after, that how after Karbala the whole Umayyad enterprise fell apart. And then after that, for hundreds of years, the only people who could rule Muslims claimed to be in the name of the Ahlul Bayt. The Abbasids, the Buyids, the Fatimids, although they may have not executed that, but their claim to rule or right to rule was based on that. So, it's not that Muslims will continue to follow the message of the Prophet all the time. But there will be people amongst Muslims who will be inspired by this to force them or to correct them from time to time.
Iqbal, thank you very much for this introduction. I just want to ask a question relating to this human behavior in terms of barbarism and exploitation. You gave a couple of examples from history. For example, how the Crusades managed to convince the larger crowd that the Muslims were barbaric. My point is that in every piece of society, even today's history, if you look at it, majority of the human beings are decent individuals with basic human values, and it's always a couple of percentage or the leaders within a society who actually create the mindset within the larger community of how bad the victims are, and that's why let's go and exploit the victims or damage the victims. Has there any studies been done as to what creates such individuals in the world? I mean, is the motivation simply personal wealth, personal gain, personal fame? Or are there other things that motivate these individuals, which are not the majority of the society, or not the majority of the people by any means?
I think power is a much more complicated thing than personal gain. Some people are after power, some people are after empire, some people are after other things. But it is not also true to say that the majority of people are not that way inclined. If they are misinformed, they will be that way inclined. So, it is not, for example, possible to argue that a lot of people did not support slavery when it happened. From Africa to the Americas. A lot of people supported it, benefited from it, and argued for it. So it is possible to create a narrative which is false. And this is one of the insights of Marx. Marx says that somehow the bourgeoisie, what he calls, petty entrepreneurs, they think that they have a God-given right to exploit labor. And they believe so. It's not like, and they, if you look at Weber, Max Weber, who is the other, he says now this can be theorized into a theory of religion, a Protestantism, how you can continue to do that in a religious framework, whilst believing sincerely that you are doing God's work. And so,
It's a question of how these things come about and how societies, whole societies, can fall prey to this. Of course, once you have corrective mechanisms, for example, like when you see why slavery came apart, it's also not by non-Muslim thinkers, Muslim thinkers into here or something. It was indigenous thinkers who started to say, hey, wait a minute, this is wrong. We can't do that. As human beings, we cannot do it. And so you had Wilberforce and others who led to its banning over 200 years. Or you look at something very simple. For a long period of time, people in everywhere, and still some people do, thought that women are inferior in their intellect to men. Even now, when only 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I think, somebody like Lauren Sumners, who was the president of Harvard University, he makes a comment that why are there so few women Nobel Prize winners? Is there something wrong with women? And on that he had to resign, because women say, what are you talking about? But you see, there is a narrative here, and this was going as far as saying they should not be educated, they shouldn't be given the vote, they shouldn't be done this or that, which had to be systematically broken down. Now it's going all the other way, that there's no difference between men and women. This is also going to another extreme. But the point is, you can create a narrative about people, and racism is the most powerful one. You can see that in many societies. You see that in white societies, you see that anybody non-white is inferior. In Asian societies, you have discrimination against black people, and so on. And these are not looked upon as wrong or unjust until you start to think about it. If you challenge that narrative, you can see it. The point here is that and we will see tomorrow, what Imam Hussain was trying to do is to challenge a narrative which was building up, that this is the right way to do it. Kingdom and hereditary kingdom like that, without concern for the piety of the person. Because it's universally agreed, for example, that Yazid was, by all accounts, totally non-practicing. Drinking, womanizing, this, and he had they say he had a monkey as a pet as well. So, now Muawiyah says, I'm going to put him as my successor. And they said, but he is not. They said, but that's not the point I'm talking about. I want to keep the empire intact. The piety of the person is irrelevant. Now that is the order which the Imam was trying to challenge once and for all. That is not irrelevant.
Thank you. Are there any more questions?
Okay, touching the slavery is another challenging. What is exactly what we can challenge towards what Quran says, Ma malakat imanakum? How do we Muslim going to challenge that?
We want to look at the position of Islam on slavery. I think really it needs a full lecture. But I think we will also come to the same conclusion that slavery is wrong and it should be banned. The Quranic narrative is only intermediate, in the sense that in an existing predominance of slavery, that is how you move. Otherwise, you end up with this very silly narrative in Pakistan. When they wanted to ban slavery, some of the obscurantist Muslims. They said that if you ban slavery, you deprive us from the sawab of freeing slaves. So we don't want to descend to that level of problematic. But inshallah, in one lecture, we will cover it.
Thank you. I think we've run out of time there, so we'll have to end. Thank you very much. Salaam.